Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harrah and the poker coach, Joe McGowan. I wanna hold them like they do in Texas State. Brought to you by Poker Stars, Reactor Watches, and the Poker Players Alliance.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
You got to know.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Coming up on the show today, a recap of the second week of the World Series of Poker main event as they whittled it down to their November 9. Also, a man who we think will someday be in the Poker Hall of Fame, the professor, Howard Lederer, will join us later on in the show. The main event started with 7,319 players on July 5th, and on July 17th, or actually early in the morning of Sunday, July 18th, they had finally narrowed it down to the nine guys who will be there. You were one of the original November 9 2 years ago. This year, a guy you know is probably the best-known name among them. Last year, we had Phil Ivey in the November 9. This year, the best-known pro, in fact, the only name a lot of people are going to know, is Michael the Grinder Mizrachi.
Absolutely. I played with Mike with the Grinder several different times last year in the World Series main event. On day two, we were at the feature table together. In fact, I took probably two-thirds of his chips. So, you know, it can work both ways. Last year, it was my turn to take his. This year, I may have been very lucky not to have been at the table with him because he seemed to be on a pretty good roll.
The Grinder has had an unbelievable World Series of Poker. He started it off that first week of July by winning the $50,000 buy-in Poker Players Championship, the eight-game Best Players in the World Championship. He took that down, and how about going at the beginning of that all the way through to finishing up by making the final table of the main event?
Oh, it's unbelievable. His family has had a heck of a series there. He's got a brother that's got several caches, and I'm not mistaken, all three of his brothers cashed in the main event. Didn't they all four cash in it?
I think they did, yes.
That's just unbelievable. One of them went out like 700 and something, one of them 500 and something, and one of them like 150th. It's just unbelievable. They got four of them to cash in the main event. That's a record that'll never be matched, I'll bet.
Now, the Grinder goes to the final table, seventh in chips. He's got about $14.5 million. And as we've learned in previous years, the number of chips you have does not necessarily indicate where you're going to end up. For instance, take the guy with the most chips there, Jonathan Duhamel, who is a 22-year-old poker pro from Quebec, Canada, who is the chip leader with 66 million chips in his stack. Now, I think last year when Darvin Moon was the chip leader, he had something like 63 million, so he's in a kind of a similar position, isn't he?
Yeah, very much so. He's got a huge percentage of the chips. He's going in there as absolutely a favorite. I don't know how you can not call him a favorite with that kind of a chip stack. But the swings here can be huge. Again, this is poker. Look what happened to Johnny Chan that went out about 150th in it. He got pocket kings, the second best possible starting hand you can have, and ran into aces and crippled himself. Shortly thereafter, he gets jacks, puts his in there, and runs into aces. And he's out of the tournament, just
yep.
like that, in two hands.
Yep.
So, doesn't take a whole lot.
Look what happened with you. Look what happened with you in 2008 when you went to the November 9 as the chip leader with 26
yep.
million. At the time, everybody had fewer starting chips than they do now, so the numbers aren't quite the same. But you took quite a hit early on before you ground your way back up and finally ended up in third place in 08.
I dropped all the way down to 4% of the chips at one time. Yeah, I was down... Similar to where Joe Cotta last year, I think, was down to 3% and
yep.
came back to win it.
Yep.
So it can happen. And I'll tell you what, the Grinder earned his name. If you followed those last couple of days, he was a short stack most of the last day there. I took a couple of hits, went down on it, and just hung in there. I mean, he's floating around 2 million, 3 million when everybody else has got 10 and 15 and 20 and just hanging on through 16 people left, 14 people left, 12 people left, and finally made it into the nine. I think he chipped up a couple of different times there to get back into this. Did very well. He's by far, in my opinion, the most experienced player, and since I don't haven't played some of the others, the best player that I've played against is on that table.
He's also
he's one to be feared.
He's also at 29 years old, Dennis, the second oldest guy at the table. I mean,
okay. Yeah. Let's not go there.
Well, you know, 2 years ago when you were in the initial November 9, you know, you, middle-aged guy, you made it there. Last year, Darvin Moon, middle-aged guy, makes it there. This year, the oldest guy at the table is Soi Nguyen, a medical supply salesman from Santa Ana, California, Vietnamese guy who is 37 years old, which makes him 8 years older than the grinder, and everybody else is younger than that. They're 22, 23, 24, 25 years old. What does that say about No Limit Hold'em in the year 2010?
Well, the thing of it is, if you look at the average age of the field there, I don't know what it was this year, but there was just a huge number of people that were 30 and younger. The medium age, maybe not the average, because, again, we had some guys are up there in their 90s, but the medium age had to be in the high 20s, I would think. So just a huge, huge number of players there that are 24, 25, 26 that are there, trying to make a go of it and succeeding. These guys are good. Don't kid yourself.
Let me just
maybe 24, 25 years old, but I'm telling you, they're good.
Let me just run down who is left at the final table besides Mizrachi and Duhamel. The guy who's second in shifts with $46 million is John Dolan, 24-year-old guy from Bonita Springs, Florida. Third place is another 24-year-old, Joseph Chong, who's from La Mirada, California, a South Korean guy who won himself a circuit event earlier this year. In fourth place is John Raisner, another 24-year-old poker pro from Florida, who, by the way, is going to be our guest next week here at the final table. In fifth place is a 25-year-old guy, Canadian guy from BC, by the name of Matthew Jarvis. Then in sixth place, we've got an Italian named Filippo Candio. After Antoine Saoud last year, we learned that you've got to have one European at the final table, and Filippo Candio will do that. Then you've got the grinder. Then you've got Soi Nguyen, who I mentioned before, and the guy who is the short stack at the table with just over $7.6 million is a 25-year-old poker pro from St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Not St. Louis, Missouri, but St. Louis Park, Minnesota, by the name of Jason Senti. So we're going to try to have as many of them on over the course of the next couple of months as we possibly can. They're all taking a four-month break or going off and playing in other tournaments elsewhere. Let's talk about a couple of the stories from the main event, including a guy by the name of Matt Affleck, who was one of the chip leaders through most of the first week of the main event. He put together a huge stack of chips and then got into it with the guy who ended up being the chip leader, Jonathan Duhamel, who I just mentioned a couple of minutes ago, and they got into it in a pot with 40 million chips in the middle. Have you seen the details of this hand, Dennis?
I have seen it. I was actually following. People were texting me right after it happened about the particular hand because it was such a heartbreaker for Matt.
Yep.
He played it very, very well. And as it turned out, it was one of those crusher hands you've got to be aware of. The favorite hand of everybody, pocket jacks. That's what one gentleman had.
That's what Jonathan had.
Yes. How everybody worries about how to play it. If I remember right, there was some betting pre-flop. The flop came out there, and both of them, he ended up with jacks for an overpair of what was on the board.
Right. Here's what happened. Jonathan pre-flop, Jonathan made it about a half a million. Matt three-bet him to $1.5 million. That brought the action back to Jonathan, who four-bet to just under $4 million, and Matt just called with his pocket aces. So there was $8 million in chips before the flop. The flop came out 10-9-7 rainbow. So you're right. Jonathan then has jacks as his overpair, and Matt, of course, has the aces.
Yes.
Jonathan checks, and Matt bets $5 million. And Jonathan just calls. Then there's a queen on the turn. Jonathan checks again. Affleck only has about $11.5 million in chips, so he puts it all in. I mean, there's $18 million in the pot. Of course, he's going to put it all in there with his aces. Jonathan tanks for quite a while and finally calls with his jacks.
Yep.
$42 million in the pot at that point. This is the hand that's going to decide who the chip leader is.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And the river comes an 8, giving Jonathan a gut shot straight.
See, at that time, no, I don't. Was that a gut shot?
Yeah, because the flop was 10, 9, 7, and a queen on the turn. So the 8 was right there in the gut.
Yeah, but he had jacks. So
he could have hit a king,
jack,
too.
Jack, queen, so a king. So yeah. he had an open-ender.
You're right.
A gut shot.
Sorry, you're right.
So he's actually looking at it. That stage for the other $11 million, he had the pot odds and everything. He had to make the call, even if he thought he was beat. Because he's looking at 8 outs for the straight, and the two of them, he's got 10 outs there. So, you know, he's a 25% chance to catch one of those cards. The whole problem, and I've stated this before, this is such a huge, huge tournament, and there's such huge pots in this. I have no idea why preflop with his pocket aces, after all the action, after Matt coming back at him, after Jonathan coming back and Matt, the Matt didn't shove preflop. I honestly don't have a clue why not.
Yeah.
There's so much money in that pot. He's already got a big percentage of his chips out there. Don't screw around with trying to trap a guy. Don't screw around with trying to get funny. That's a danger flop, actually, with tens and nines and then a queen showing up. I mean, you had to put him on a premium hand with the different bets back and forth. What did he put him on, kings? It had to be either kings or jacks or the guy's got a set.
Right.
I just don't agree with that. He could have taken that down with the chips he had. Would have bumped him up to, what, $30 million plus. He'd have been second in chips and probably not even had to see a flop.
Yep. So Matt Affleck was eliminated at that point. His pocket aces didn't do anything but take him to the rail and a payout of about $500,000. Not a bad return on what he took in there.
Oh, no.
But considering what he could have made and the riches that come when you make the final table, I agree he misplayed those aces. Couple of other stories from the main event that we have to talk about today. One is the story of a Brazilian who I think is a PokerStars pro. Do you know a guy named Walter Salles from Brazil?
I actually think I do. I think I've played with the gentleman before. I'd love to see a picture of him to make sure, but the name is familiar. I've played down the LAPTs a number of times. I've been down there in Uruguay and Chile and Peru and Argentina, and I'm going back there again next month. But I think I know the gentleman, yes.
He is a race car driver turned poker player who on day 5 had about 180,000 in chips. He also had jacks, raised it to 16,000. The big blind called. The flop came out king 9-9 with two clubs. Gualter led out for 30,000. The other guy led out for 30,000. Gualter put him on a flush draw and called. On the turn, the other guy says, "How many chips do you have left?" Gualter counts his chips. He has 160,000. The other guy bets enough to put them all in, 160,000. And Gualter calls. And the other guy turns over his cards. He had 8-9, which means he flopped trip nines. And Gualter, of course, just has his jacks at that point. He loses the hand. He gets up to leave. And the dealer says, "Wait a second. You had a chip on your card that was not included in the 160,000 that you were using to protect your cards. You're still in this.
Yep.
You have one $1,000 chip left." So he sits back down. He pays his ante with his last chip. It gets raised. He has pocket sixes. They hold up. He wins the antes and the blinds. He's got 9,000. He folds his next hand. On the hand after that, he's under the gun. He moves in with ace, deuce of diamonds. A guy comes over the top. He has ace, jack, but Gualter hits a deuce on the river. Now he's up to 35,000. The very next hand in the big blind, he has ace, king. He's all in. He gets called by two guys. He hits his ace on the flop. He's got 105,000. Two hands later, Dennis, he has ace king again. He moves all in. He gets called by pocket sevens. He hits another ace. He's got $250,000 in chips. Then he starts to play normally again. An hour goes by. He gets aces, doubles up to $500,000. Before the story is over, he's gone from 1,000 to $1,250,000 in chips in just a couple of levels of a day, where he was living out the dream of chip and a chair. The old Jack Treetop Strauss story, if you don't know it, from 1982, Jack Treetop Strauss was in a similar situation. His chip had been stuck under a cocktail napkin. He thought he was all in. He wasn't. He took that one chip and turned it into a championship of the main event
back in 1982. Gualter Salas was trying to do the same thing. Unfortunately, the luck turned against him, and he ended up going out in 117th place. But how about that?
Well, he turned that one chip into a nice paycheck, is what he did. That's unbelievable.
57,000 he gets. Here's another story we have to talk about. Philip.
A quick comment on that one, Paul.
Yeah.
Because I've seen this, I don't know how many different times, and in tournaments even this last month. I saw a gentleman take a bad beat. He went from like 20,000 down to 3,000. On the very next hand, he stands up, takes all his chips, puts them in the middle without even looking at his cards. He has given up totally.
Yeah.
And that's just bad play. That's all there is to it. You can't do such a thing like that.
Well,
you've got to go ahead and play your cards, and you should never give up.
Dennis, you know that when I played the circuit event here in St. Louis at Harrah's St. Louis back in April, I took a horrible beat where my aces got cracked by kings, and I went down to 4,000 in chips. I went for a walk, came back. Guy next to me said, I guess those chips are going in pretty soon. And I turned to him and I said, no, I'm going to win this tournament. I didn't win it. But I made it to fifth place at the final table of that tournament by simply remembering the chip and the chair story. And now everybody needs to remember it. Here's the story of a Belgian player named Philip Goossens, who qualified on some European site that I'm not familiar with, some poker site there called BWIN, which paid for the tournament entry plus hotel and travel expenses until July 12th. Now remember, the tournament started with day 1A on July 5th. They would pay to put you through July 12th, which meant effectively through day 2, which was Saturday and Sunday, 2A and 2B. If you made day 3, BWIN said they would extend your hotel room, but you'd have to pay for your own rebooking of your flight. Well, Philip Goossens did make it to day 3 with average chips of 90,000, but he was out of money. And he said he couldn't afford the 1,000 euros it would cost to rebook the flight. Plus, he said, I have no other money. I have no clean clothes. I'm very lonely. I miss my girlfriend back home. And Dennis, he went home, leaving those 90K in chips to be blinded off while he was on the plane back to Belgium. How about that?
Wow. That almost leaves me speechless. I have no idea what to even comment about that one. I'm telling you, if I had to sleep in the hallway and go on a starvation diet, I'm not leaving the table with like a chip there.
This is your dream.
Wow.
You've made it to the main event. You probably had looked forward to it for months after qualifying online. You get there, and here's the other thing. You could have walked up to any 5 people at the Rio, told them your story, offered them some equity in what you could earn if you just made it to day 4, which was when people made the money. And out of those 5 people, you certainly would have found at least one person who would give you $2,000 for 20%, 10%, 15% of your action. Don't you think?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. I guess, maybe the rest of the story was more pressing, but he literally was not comfortable and he wanted to leave and his girlfriend and whatever, I don't know. But yes, I guarantee if he'd approached me with it or approached you or approached... Yeah, if he just approached the people at the tournament and kind of said, hey, can you steer me to somebody? Anybody that's making day 3 has a very, very good shot of making the money.
Yep.
And he had 90,000. He wasn't short stack. He wasn't like he had only a few blinds. Good grief, he's got money to play with there. Yeah, that's unbelievable.
Here's the funny thing. He also made day 4. Because... He had 90,000 in chips. He got blinded off all day long. At the end of the day, he was left with 3 big blinds. So Philip Goossens made day 4 without actually being there at the World Series of Poker. I love
that. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I do. I love it. That's excellent.
I also want to congratulate a St. Louisan who everybody in town knows by his snowman who he uses as his card protector, Terry Schruldreher, who I happen to have played a tournament with at Harrah's on Saturday here, but he made it to day 4 of the main event, which means that he cashed this year. We were rooting for him, and he seemed very happy whenever anybody came over to congratulate him at the tournament here on Saturday. One other thing we've got to talk about is Ted Forrest and Mike Matisau and the unbelievable weight loss prop bet. Now, you and the poker coach Joe McGowan had your own weight loss bet earlier this year. You both made your goal weights, so nobody had to pay off. But Ted weighed 188 pounds, when he made the bet with Mike Mattisau that he could lose 50 pounds and get down to 138 by the end of the main event. If he did, Mattisau would owe him $2 million. Last Tuesday at 5:14 p.m., Ted got on a scale on the stage at the Pavilion Room at the Rio and weighed in at 138 pounds. He lost 50 pounds in 2 months, and Mattisau owes him $2 million.
Unbelievable. I hear these things all the time. I did mine a little more sensible. I took a couple of months of it. I did lose over 30 pounds, but, you know, I took my time doing it, tried to be somewhat reasonable. That's almost as bad as the story. Wasn't it Huck Seed that made the bet with that he could lose, God, it was somewhere around 25 or 30 pounds. I hope I get the figures right. I think it was like 25 to 30 pounds he was going to lose. They made the bet. They said they're going to have their official weigh-in then. His goal was like 190 or whatever, because Huxley's a tall, tall guy.
Yeah.
The weigh-in was going to be 3 days later. What he did, unbeknownst to the guy he made the bet with, is he didn't eat anything. He ran a marathon, went to a sauna, did everything in the world. He lost the weight in those 3 days, and when he went to the official weigh-in, stepped on the scales, looked over and said, pay me.
Yeah.
The other guy didn't even have a chance to get started.
I love that one. With this one, Ted Forrest is 5'10", and I've seen the pictures of him when he weighed in. He was 138. He didn't look healthy, but I hear from people in Vegas that he's back into the 150s now. I'm guessing that's because he just started to eat normally again.
Oh, yeah.
The real question is, does Mike Mattisau have $2 million?
Mike will find a way to take care of it, I'm quite sure. But, yeah, Mike was probably not expecting that.
No.
And actually, halfway through the World Series out there, I was talking to a couple of the people, and they said he'd done well. He'd lost like 25 pounds of it. So that means he was down to like 163. He had to lose another 25 pounds in the last 2 weeks after already stripping, you know, the water weight and the easy pounds off.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I bet Mattisau spread some of the action around. There are probably some other pros who were part of that who were stunned when they saw Ted step on there and click off 138 on the scale. All right. We're going to take a break here in a moment, and then we're going to come back with our interview with Howard Lederer, who knows all these guys so well. He's been one of the top pros for a long time. He's one of the guys behind Full Tilt Poker, and you'll hear that interview here in just a couple of minutes. But first, speaking of online websites, this portion of our show is brought to you by PokerStars.net, where you can go online now and qualify to play on TV on The Big Game, which returns on August 9th. Are you going to be part of that, Dennis?
Yeah, I'm supposed to be. They were trying to send me down to Brazil. I'm not for sure. There are so many things going on with PokerStars, so many things in the world. It's unbelievable. You've got The Big Game. We've got the Million Dollar Challenge coming up later this fall. They have tournaments right now that you can qualify for free at PokerStars.net to go to Brazil, to go to Argentina, to go to London. It's just scary almost, the different places you can go. My gosh, if you guys want to do something and have some fun and get a paid vacation out of it and a chance to earn more, go to PokerStars.net. You know, you can play against me or any of the other pros that are there. And good grief, anywhere in the world you want to go almost, you can qualify for it there or on the TV. Can you imagine being the loose cannon and qualifying for that? That'd be awesome.
That would. So go to PokerStars.net, download the software, and find the PokerStar in you. He's Team PokerStars Pro Dennis Phillips. I am Paul Harris in Harris, St. Louis. This is the final table on 590 of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
From Harris, St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is the final table, the only show in St. Louis with a poker millionaire. That's Dennis Phillips and his co-host, Paul Harris, on 590 the Fan, KFNS.
Sitting at table 2 in the Harris Poker Room today. A few days ago, I was over at table 14 playing in one of the many tournaments they have here, twice a day, every day. And if you want to play, you got low-level buy-ins of $40 all the way up to their monthly $310 buy-in, which is the one where I finished fourth over the weekend. There are also some great cash games going in here on a regular basis, but of course Harris has much more than that. And if you're looking for good places to eat, they've got the Eat Up Buffet upstairs with so many different items you can't even count them. They got Charlie Gito's for some terrific Italian food. They've got the Range for the steakhouse, and several other options for you as well. Even if you just want to get a cup of soup and a sandwich, you can get that while you're playing the table games, the slots, or the poker here at Harrah's St. Louis. For details, go to their website, harrahsstlouis.com. We're happy to call it the home of this weekly poker radio show, The Final Table. Now, our interview with the professor, Howard Lederer, one of the founding members of Full Tilt Poker, the owner of two World Series of Poker bracelets, one in a high-low limit Omaha, and the other one in no limit, deuce to seven low ball. He's cashed 70 times in tournaments, over $5 million in tournament winnings, and, of course, a lot more from that website he's been associated with. Here's our conversation with Howard Lederer. Let's talk about the 2010 World Series of Poker. I understand that your main event ended, sadly, on the last hand of day one, but you did have some good news getting to the heads-up finale of the Tournament of Champions. It was a pretty big three guys there at the end, you and Johnny Chan and Huck Seed, and Huck eventually...
Okay, don't just limit it to the final three. Let me tell you, that lineup was a lineup from hell if you had to fight them.
Yeah,
for you to finish heads-up in that is a heck of a pat on the back.
I would say 27 very tough competitors. Well, 26 very tough competitors and one online guy. Not to diss online players at all,
right.
But you know what I mean, 26, you know... Yeah. Poker legends all playing there, and you got to the end. Tell us a little bit about that TOC experience this
year. Well, I mean, it was certainly a lot of fun. There were no soft spots. I didn't happen to be paired at my table with the online guy. So so I didn't get the one soft spot out of 27 to play with.
Yeah.
It was one of those tournaments, actually. I really felt really, really good about how I played. But also, it went the way I've won a lot of my tournaments. And I think the way that you're supposed to win tournaments. You know, tournament poker isn't cash game poker. It's not about taking the best of every situation. It's actually about limiting your variance. Because variance is what... If you play a style where your variance is high, yeah, you'll have the highs, but the lows knock you out of the tournament. And if you play a style that keeps your chips more steady, trending up, that just maximizes your chance of going deep in a tournament. So that's the style I like to play in tournaments, and I think it's the right style. And that's kind of what I did. You know, I was relatively low stacked, but I never got all in, except one time I had the ace high flush, and Phil Hellmuth on the turn made a set, and we got all in. I certainly could have gone broke there, but I wasn't all in other than that, even though I was short stacked the whole way. And, you know, I made a few hands at the final table and got down to three-handed, and then it was pretty much an epic three-handed battle. I mean, I think we were three-handed for a good 4 hours.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And pretty much even in chips?
It seemed like no one ever got a hold of more than about 430, about half the chips, so the other two had the other half, and no one really got below 100.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of us shared those various positions along the way during that whole period of time. But finally, Huck sort of crippled him, and then I knocked him out, Johnny Chan, that is, and we got heads up. And, you know, I had a real good chance to win that tournament. I did have Huck all in as a 3-1 favorite.
Yeah.
I haven't been as disappointed by a second in a long time. As that event, I really felt it, because I knew that I had played well enough to win. I had them all in with a chance to win, and I didn't. And that's a really nice tournament to have, on your resume.
Yeah.
So maybe next year.
Plus, you'd be the only brother-sister Tournament of Champions.
Well, yeah, I guess since there are only four total now, yes, one would hope not.
That is true. Yeah. Wait. It impresses me. You've been in 24 consecutive main events.
Yeah, I doubt if there are more than three or four or five players that have played more consecutive.
Yeah.
Because I believe the record right now is held by Howard Tahoe Andrew.
37.
27.
27.
Or 27. I'm sorry, yes. 27.
So that's only a few more. So, I mean, and it's weird. You know, I'm not young. But I'm in my 40s.
Good,
I mean,
great,
this
yeah.
is a game where people are competitive into their 70s. So it's just, I guess, as a testament to I haven't been sick, you know, that week where I just couldn't play, or there hasn't been some family emergency, or, you know, or for whatever reason I lost interest for like a few years. You know, I've actually gone to 25 World Series, you know, and something that your listeners kind of may have a hard time wrapping their head around. It seems like these days, look, if you're serious about poker, of course, it's a given that you will play in the main event.
Yeah.
That was not the case back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. The first year I went out, I was a professional player, a successful professional player playing in New York. When I went out to the World Series, I was going out mainly for the cash games. I played a few tournaments.
Yep.
I did well. I think I made about, I seem to recall making about 30,000, grinding the cash games. And that was great, but that didn't mean that I was going to plunk that 10,000 to play in an event. And they did not have super satellites or all these other ways to get in. The only way you could get into that main event was either plunk down the 10,000 or play a one table satellite for 1,000.
Wow.
So I put myself on a $3,000 budget.
Okay.
And if I didn't get in, I wasn't going to play, and mm-hmm. I didn't get in. So, you know, that first year I didn't play in the main event.
And you were 21.
I guess I was 21 that year.
And the next year you were 20. Now, just to put that in perspective, we're talking about a time when, you know, Peter Eastgate and Joe Catta are winning it at age 21. How many 21 or 22-year-olds were plunking down 10 grand or even 1,000 to play that super satellite at the time?
Very, very. I was really, really, like, freakishly young, really. I mean, you know.
It had to be.
Yeah. And
now, doesn't it seem like they're all 21?
right.
But
exactly.
there were so. Only, when Johnny won it in 88, wait, no, 87, there was less than 200 people in the main event.
It was 163, I believe.
Okay, never mind. I should never question things with the
professor. Well, because but, I mean, that was the first one I played.
I
got down to fifth. You know,
wow.
So I do know how many people, or I think I know. I could be wrong, but I know it's right around 160.
Yeah.
And you know, and the reason it's not there were plenty more than 160 players out there to play in the preliminary events. You know, so it was one of those things. The preliminary events got more players than the main event.
Yeah.
You know, now of course it's all it's all flip flop. So you know, the largest number tournament is this big buy-in $10,000 main event, which is great, but it was a different time. And but once you play, so that next year actually I wouldn't have played, but I got in on one of my three.
Mm-hmm.
I put myself on the same three satellite bankroll, and I got in on my second try, I believe.
Yep.
And I played, and of course once you play,
now
it was, you know, and I was getting a little more successful. The idea of just putting down the 10,000 wasn't a big deal to me. In fact, for the whole like two or three days prior to the main event, it was satellite time. I mean, a lot of, like, you know, tough pros, that was their grind toward the end of the World Series, was I'm just going to play one table satellites for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
Those are great spots. There were a lot of amateur players coming in to try and win their seat, and you would just sit there and you might play 15 one table satellites over a few day period, you know. So at that point I knew I'd be playing in this thing for the rest of my life.
I know one other thing that's very different from when you first started playing in the World Series of Poker main event to now. There weren't many multi-million-dollar prop bets back then. But now you're involved in, well, at least one. Were you involved in any of the Tom Dwan prop bets?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So you were very happy to see him go 0 for 57.
Yes, and that second place was a bit of a sweat.
Were you there?
I was there playing in, I forget exactly which event.
10K but stud.
There was a 10K stud tournament, and we were kind of hearing the comp, but we couldn't hear that well, so we were basically all kind of zoned in on the cheering. There was a different kind of cheer for Tom and for the other players.
Uh-huh.
And that isn't even to say, like, there were a couple guys at that table that definitely had a good crowd. It wasn't about even volume. It was just you could tell the Tom cheer. So it's a different group of people way they were cheering, and you were just like zoned in. And then, you know, it would be like 15 minutes and you hadn't really heard any cheering, and you knew that was good. Basically, in general, we were rooting for no cheering.
Yeah. And you also have a prop bet with Mr. Ivy, we understand. That's a multi-million dollar deal.
You know, I'm a big believer that it's really, really, really hard to win a bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly these days. And it's getting harder. And, you know, Phil feels like he's a favorite to win two bracelets in 3 years. Now, he's won three in the last 2 years, but but as they say, past performance doesn't guarantee future results.
Right.
And that isn't to say that Phil isn't the best player out there and the most likely guy to win a bracelet, but I just think that's a very tough thing to do. And I know that he won one this year.
Halfway to the goal.
No, not halfway. It's 2 and 3 years.
Right.
So,
he's only got to win one more in the next two years.
Oh, he is halfway. Yeah. I'm talking about my goal. So, so I'm 1/3 of the way to my goal, and he's halfway to his goal. So I guess he has a nice edge. But I still feel like he's got a lot of work cut out for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to give you an idea how hard it is, we had a fantasy league this year. There were 11 teams, 8 players per team. And we drafted players. So that's 88 players. And presumably, the 88 players drafted were just about the 88 most likely guys to win a bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
How many bracelets do you think those 88 players won this year at the World Series of Poker?
I would bet it didn't go into double digits.
3.
Wow.
3.
Yeah.
Okay, so what we're saying is... let's do it in a normal lifetime, right? So, I mean, sort of a poker lifetime. If we cut that in half to 44, that's 1.5 bracelets.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that works out to is the 88, you know, some guy, let's say the 40th, 50th best player in the world, just based on what happened this year, would play in the World Series of Poker 44 years and win 1.5 bracelets.
Mm-hmm.
That's how hard it's getting. Okay? Now, Mr. Ivy may be the most likely guy. But if you win a bracelet every 20 years, you know, a top player wins a bracelet every 20 years, I'm just willing to bet that he won't do 2 and 3 years. Now, I mean, I wouldn't bet it now, obviously, because he only has to win one in the next 2 years.
And, right.
And, you know, he's been going at that pace for a while. But I think I'm far from dead.
I also think that if he does it, the millions come back to you in terms of the free publicity for
him as a
spokesperson for you. And
no, I mean, look, Ivy's the best poker player in the world. That's not going to change whether he wins another bracelet.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's one of the things people have talked to me about. You know, there have been situations where a guy like Phil or really any top player gets heads up against an unknown player in, like, a big tournament, and they'll say, wow, you know, who's the pressure on? And I say, it's not even a question. It's not like Phil is worried about the embarrassment of, you know, no matter what happens when Phil Ivey loses to an amateur, on the rare occasions he might, if he's heads up in a tournament, he will be Phil Ivey. He'll be the best player in the world tomorrow.
Yeah.
That other guy?
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's some guy just trying to make a reputation. So mm-hmm. It's clear that, I mean, at least it's clear to me that the pressure is on. You know, sort of the upstart player. And, of course, that helps a guy like Phil Ivey late in a tournament.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't realize, and you do, obviously, but like in No Limit, when you get the money in, you may be an 80-20 favorite. That means that you lose one out of every five hands. So I don't care who you are or how much better you are than the other players. There's always that element that comes in there on the turn in the river. So I would always bet for Phil. But
I know you got to run, but I just got to go back to the Durr thing for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
I just looked it up. He played 50 events this year. There were a total of 57. How is that physically possible? I mean, I think he probably can't make a lot of day twos.
He was just he would enter some events and not even. I would imagine he ended off his chips in a few tournaments.
He was more tabling live events.
Absolutely, Ivy. You can go back to Poker News and follow the updates. Ivy was in the heads-up tournament, I think a 2,500 PLO, and he was in, I forget which event it was, but he was in another event. It was right there in the middle of the series.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a hold of chips in all three tournaments at the same time.
Wow.
He won the first two rounds of the heads-up in the same night that he... I think he finished 12th in the PLO, and he got a hold of a nice stack on day one of some other tournament that he actually went moderately deep in. So, you know, he was doing all that. He was playing three tournaments at the same time and doing well in all three of them. Now, look, you have to be look, he would admit that he was lucky. I mean, he wasn't playing well in the heads up, right? He was going over to his table. He had anteed off a few chips. It's break time. And he's waiting for any old ace-10 to just move in. you know, and that's how he did it. You know, he just moved in, he ran into a pair of eights, and he won the race, and he was on to the next round. It wasn't like he was trying to play well like Phil Ivey plays well, because he didn't have time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's the kind of guy that can do that.
Multi-tabling when you're at home and you got all the screens open is one thing. Having to run from the Amazon room to the Pavilion room, or even across the Amazon room to one feature table to the rest, that's insanity.
Well, again, and like the viewers maybe don't realize, a typical day here would be there would be one tournament that would start at noon, and another one would start then and later on at 5. So if you make a day two, which also starts at around, say, 2 or 3, depending on which one, you have a tournament starting at noon, one starting at 2, and one starting at 5.
Mm-hmm.
So that means at 5:30, you're in three tournaments, cards are being dealt to you. You physically can't be in three places, therefore you are trying to run back and forth, or you're being blinded down in two. For him to be able to stay in three and chip up in three just doesn't even seem possible.
And it's your fault, Howard, because without the bet, he would never do that.
Right. Well, I wasn't the only one that bet with him. But, yeah, he had a lot of bracelet bets, and, you know, I think it keeps him focused. I think it's good for the World Series to have the best player in the world care about these things. Because I really do think that if he didn't have any of these bets, he's the best player in the world. There's a little place called Bobby's Room down the street where he figures to make, you know, seven figures.
Yep.
During the World Series of Poker.
And where he would go at the end of that day, right?
Well, sometimes he would play there, but I think he'd camp out there and really sort of forget about the World Series and maybe save for, you know, the 50K, you know, a few of the big, big, big events. And that wouldn't be good for the World Series. It wouldn't be good for poker. So,
right.
I think it's a fun bet. I certainly hope I win, but in the meantime, I think it's all good for poker to just have him playing in these things.
Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris talking with the professor, Howard Lederer, here on the Final Table on 5-9 of the Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcasts on thechipleader.com, or subscribe to him on iTunes. In our next segment, we'll talk to him about passing legislation regarding online poker, which is the mission of the Poker Players Alliance, which will be paying a lot of attention tomorrow at noon when Barney Frank's committee starts talking about H.R. 2267, the Internet Gambling Regulation, Consumer Protection, and Enforcement Act. This is a bill that now has 69 co-sponsors. It was introduced last year. We're keeping a very close eye on it. It would set up a regulatory framework for licensing online poker and other gaming in the United States. We'll have more details for you on this show and, of course, on the Poker Players Alliance website, which you can visit anytime and become a member for just like $20. ThePPA.org is that website. ThePPA.org. Now, more of our conversation with the professor, Howard Lederer.
He mentioned about the Hall of Fame. Well, not only with your poker playing, but what people don't realize is everything you do behind the scenes. Massive amount of charity work. I've been lucky enough to actually make a Final Table at one of your charities. I've walked Washington with you when we were doing some lobbying there. And just shortly ago, we were at a fundraiser for Harry Reid. And he came up there and spoke of you and how you had convinced him of the advantage to everybody in the U.S. for making poker, for the legalization of it, for changing the laws that are in there in Washington. And he gave credit to you for changing his mind. So that's just awesome. I mean,
what did you say?
Well, Well, you know, I did have a meeting with him. I was thrilled to get a meeting with him a little over a year ago, I think. And, I think he went into that meeting going like, oh, I gotta talk to this guy. But, you know, I'll be on to the next meeting as soon as possible. But, you know, Harry is a listener. You know, and he's a straight shooter. So I think that if I had not convinced him to even, you know, and I didn't convince him of anything. I convinced him to look at the issue. You know, but I think what he heard, you know, just about how this is going to help everybody, and that's brick-and-mortar casinos, online players, online poker sites, the banks, everything. You know, I think he agreed to look into it. And, of course, you know, it's not just Harry himself. It's his staff. But, I mean, when they really started looking into it, I think it started to make sense to them. Now, he hasn't done anything yet. I mean, Harry's a deliberate guy. I do know he's looking into it, and I think that there is a real chance. You know, we always knew that all roads lead through the Senate Majority Leader's office, not just because he's Senate Majority Leader, but because he's from Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of senators on both sides of the aisle defer to Harry when it comes to matters of gaming, whether online or brick and mortar. So he's obviously very, very important. And I think we've made a lot of progress. And I think we have a real chance this year, if not this year, maybe next.
Do you think it's something that he's going to have to wait until after Election Day? Because he's in a battle for his seat right
now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't want to get into the politics of his reelection, but tell us about...
Clearly, he's a national target. He's the face of the Democratic Party. And the National Republican Party, I think, is going to try and convince, Nevadans to basically shoot themselves in the foot and just get rid of a guy because he's the face of the Democrats or because they're angry or because they're out of work or whatever. But, I mean, this is a guy that's been fighting for Nevada for years. I mean, he's the reason why Yucca Mountain is closed down. But, you know, it's a hole in a mountain. They can start that project up any day. He's been out there. You know, he does an enormous amount of good for this state, and he's in a position, you know, a true position of power to continue to do that. I just think it would be insane for Nevadans to think about, you know,
do they not realize how much power this guy wields in Washington, what the respect he has? He's been there for term after term after term. My God, Nevadans are going to lose a huge amount of power if he isn't reelected.
But that's his problem. You know, now, this is an anti-incumbent, you know, election cycle. And it's kind of weird. I mean, if I were Harry, it's almost like, how do you campaign, right? Because the more that you remind people of all the things you've done for them and what you intend to do in the future, you're almost running against yourself because you're reminding them that you are an incumbent. You're the ultimate incumbent. You know, you're the ultimate incumbent. And there's a tremendous history on both sides of the aisle of party leadership types basically getting tossed out of office.
Yeah.
Foley, Frist was probably going to lose.
Yep.
You know, and he just got out of the way.
Yep.
There's a history of this. When people get upset at the party, then they stop thinking about what's good for them and their state. So, you know, he's in a tough fight. But I think the good news is somehow the Republicans managed to get Sharon Angle nominated. And now he actually can not run on his own record, which is a fine record.
Oh, absolutely.
And keep reminding, he can just keep reminding people about who Sharon Angle is.
Yeah.
Probably the best place to go look for things like, you know, chances on who will win an election is a place called Intrade, where... it's basically a futures markets betting site where you can bet on all kinds of things. You know, how many hurricanes will there be in hurricane season? What are the chances that we go back into a recession? Those kinds of things. And these markets where people are actually risking real money, they've shown, are tremendous predictors. Well, you know, about 2 months ago, if you went there and looked at Harry Reid re-election, If you wanted to bet on it, you only had to put up 20 for 100. So you're getting 4 to 1, 80 to 20. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he was an enormous underdog. He was 20%.
Yeah.
And the day that she won the Republican nomination, he went up over 50. I think he's now in the 60s.
He's a favorite now.
Yeah, exactly.
Although, anybody who's ever played Omaha knows 60-40 is no guarantee.
Absolutely. There's no guarantee. It's still a tough fight. When you consider his record, the fact that he's only 60%.
Yeah. There's a lot of turns and rivers between now and Election Day.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I'm guessing that Harry's going to play it pretty well between now and then.
And what does that mean for online poker? You said it
well,
might...
Well, I mean, I think it means that, A, during the quote-unquote lame duck session, he won't be such a lame duck. So there's a better chance that if this is something he wants to get done during that period of time, and I do agree it's going to be tough to do it before, he has a better chance of getting it done. And it also means that if this is something where, you know, he feels like there's a little more work needs to be done behind the scenes, getting the right vested interest lined up, and it's something that needs to get done next year, he's still around to get that done. So it's very important, you know, anyone who cares about poker and lives in Nevada needs to turn out in November and vote for Harry.
What does legalizing poker mean to your company, Full Tilt Poker, and Dennis is the company Dennis is associated with, Poker Stars, and Doyle's Room, and Ultimate Bet, and all the rest. What does that mean economically in terms of contributions to the American economy and the inflation of your company going forward?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, the prediction is a few billion a year for starters in terms of tax revenue. You know, I wouldn't use the term legalization. I would use the term licensed and regulated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, online poker is not illegal in this country. But it is in an area, and that's kind of a gray area. But, you know, the largest, the highest court in the land, you know, ruled that the Wire Act does not apply to poker. But we're in, so this key law that's used to, let's say, go after online sports books, okay, it doesn't apply to online poker, but it's not explicit. There's not a license. There's not regulation. The U.S. government isn't getting any tax revenue from this activity. There's not government-mandated consumer protections, which, you know, luckily poker in particular is an industry that I think is maybe most, I guess you could say, susceptible or, you know, to self-regulation, to real self-regulation. Because when people feel unsafe, when they feel like the game isn't fair, when they feel like they're being mistreated, they leave poker sites in droves. So poker sites are highly incentivized to regulate themselves. And, you know, both PokerStars and Full Tilt are with, you know, some of the toughest regulators in the world. Isle of Man with PokerStars and Alderney with Full Tilt. So it's not like it's an unregulated industry. But in the U.S., it should be licensed. It should be regulated. Mm-hmm. And this is what everyone's fighting for. This is what the Poker Players Alliance is fighting for.
Right.
Well, two things are happening, too, hopefully are happening. Number one, before the Senate does it, perhaps the House will get something in front of them and go. And plus, there's a lot of activity in some of the different states, in California, in Florida, where they're trying to legalize it within the state borders. Which
right. Well, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Okay, because the way it's going to happen in a California or a Florida is there's going to be a state monopoly. Whether it's a state lottery will do it, or maybe one of the casino licensees, the Indian casino licensees, they're going to convince, you know, the powers that be in that state, hey, you should just grant one license, we'll pay you a ton of tax, and you should just regulate it and license us. And that tends to be the smaller the jurisdiction, the more likely that's going to be the result. And if we wait around at the federal level for this stuff to happen state by state, we're going to have this balkanized poker market where it's going to be Floridians are playing against Floridians and Californians are playing against Californians. And on bad sites, poorly run sites, bad software, with very high tax rates or rake rates, which are going to have to pay for those tax rates, and we're going to literally destroy the online poker market. The Ooh. Idea of online poker is that you go and you play with everyone around the world, and there are lots of games, and that's not going to happen if we go state by state. The good news is that if the federal government gets its act done or prior to this state stuff happening, mm-hmm. you know, and Harry's aware of that issue. Once you have a federal licensing, a federal licensing regime put in place, that state stuff can't happen.
I was just wondering in the state things, because I agree with you 100%. It could be very, very bad. If the action that's happening among several different states, is that going to maybe give a little boot to the people in Washington to get something done?
Well, I think it already is. They're seeing the fact that those things are getting a little traction. Yes, mm-hmm. they're, you know, look, the good news in terms of the state stuff being tough to do is all gambling is tough to do, mm-hmm. right? Anytime you have, you know, lotteries and casinos and racetracks and, you know, you have all these, you know, entrenched gambling interests, and this is nationally and also locally, it's always very hard to do something new and keep everyone happy. So none of these state things are going to be easy, but eventually they do tend to start, they placate all the vested interests, and they eventually get something done. So we're probably looking at, in the next year or two, some of these state yeah. initiatives happening if the federal thing doesn't happen first. So I think, you know, Harry Reid in Washington is aware of this issue, and obviously, you know, things need to get rolling.
We really appreciate you spending a half hour with us here. We know you're very, very busy. There's so much we want to talk to you about. We hope you'll come back and join us, if not in person, then maybe on the phone sometime, because there's a lot of other stuff we want to touch on with you.
Absolutely, anytime.
That is the professor, Howard Lederer, joining us here at the Final Table with Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris. Next week, Norman Shad will be here on the day that ESPN's coverage of the 2010 World Series of Poker kicks off with the 50K Players Championship. Also, one of this year's November 9, John Raisner will be on the show next week. Finally, a plug for a poker fundraiser going on at the Moolah Shrine Center in Maryland Heights. This Saturday, July 24th, 6 o'clock, $60 at the door. They'll have all sorts of cash prizes and free food and cash and beer. If you're interested, that's the Shrine Center at Fifi and Ross in Maryland Heights, Missouri, this Saturday night at 6. For Dennis Phillips and Howard Lederer, I'm Paul Harris. This is the Final Table on 590 of the Fan KFNS and KFNS.com and our podcasts on thechipleader.com.